It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the history of popcorn with Andrew Smith, author of Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. He takes America's favorite snack food from caveman cuisine to Orville Rettenbacher. Jane and Michael Stern take us to one of their top 10 restaurants in Pensacola, Florida. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner checks out range hoods, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Food editor Kathy Purvis takes us to the kitchen hop. And then there's Pears. Forget Harry and David, it was Catholic monks with too much time on their hands who brought Pears to glory. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I want to talk about carrots. And I want to begin with a little folklore. Did you know that carrots were aphrodisiacs for 17th century Italians and that people believed they stimulated milk production for nursing mothers, or that they were growing in Afghanistan centuries before Christ? And how about Paris in the 1300s? Now there, carrots were preserved for winter by cooking them in honey. Not a bad idea today. Maybe a carrot jam. Think about this. I mean, even the foods we see as ordinary have stories to tell. Well, winter's a good time for cooking with carrots. Carrots are keeping vegetables. They hold well in cool refrigerators, the way they used to keep in cool root cellars a century ago. So let's start talking about carrots by going to the market. Look for carrots that are firm, with no blemishes, and with no new sprouts coming out of their ends. Buy organic if you can. It's not only a matter of organic being better for the environment and maybe better for our health. Most of the sweetest carrots I've ever tasted have been organic ones. Now, one way of being sure that carrots are fresh dug is by buying ones with tops on. If the tops look fresh, probably the carrots are too. But remember, this is the great keeping vegetable. So if the tops aren't on, it could still be in good shape. Store the carrots in plastic bags in the warmest part of the fridge and poke some holes in the bag to allow for a little air circulation. Okay, now let's look at what you can do with carrots. Here's some basics. There's this cutting trick from Asia that cashes in on the fact that the taste of the carrot changes from its core out to its peel. It kind of goes from very intense to more delicate. Well, in Asia, people do what's called a roll cut. All you do is lay the carrot down, make an angled cut into it, roll it a quarter turn, make another angled cut, and so on. And what you get is this kind of odd, interesting shaped carrot, and it cooks up beautifully. Now let's get into real cooking. As with all vegetables, if you want the purest, most delicate flavor, steam or boil the carrots. For deeper, richer, and more complex carrot flavors, it's sort of like turning the carrots into a meaty-tasting vegetable. Brown them. And you can do this by roasting them, browning them in a skillet with a little fat, or by grilling them. Of course, there's lots of ways of cooking carrots that combine these methods. You can build an incredible assortment of flavors by fooling around with combination cooking. Here's some specific thoughts. Try what I call silken smothered carrots. This is a suave, elegant way of serving carrots. Slow cook cut up carrots in a covered sauté pan with a little butter or olive oil and salt and pepper. They cook in their own moisture, and they become wonderfully sweet and intense. Serve them sprinkled with fresh dill. Then their spicy, tangy Moroccan carrot salad. Steam the carrots with lots of sliced garlic, then toss them with cumin, lemon, sweet and hot peppers, and fresh coriander. Serve it at room temperature with grilled fish. Now, for a new take on sweet tart, do apricot-glazed carrots. Brown carrots and shallots in a big shallow pan, then cook them with white wine, water, and a handful of chopped-up dried apricots. Now, once the carrots are cooked, boil down the cooking liquid to a glaze. When you're grilling, do thyme-scented grilled carrots. Cook the carrots halfway in water, then toss them with olive oil, some fresh thyme, chopped onion, salt, pepper, and then just grill them until they're flecked with brown. The last thing to consider is a light and fresh carrot salad. No oil. This one keeps in the refrigerator for a week or more. Here's what you do. Shred up the carrots and, if available, some daikon radish. Toss with a blend of white vinegar, salt, pepper, a little sugar, lots of black pepper. Marinate that, and then just before you serve it, add some fresh mint or dill. So, try some new things with the faithful old carrot, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed is one of the largest bridal registries in the country, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today it's Popped Culture with food historian Andrew Smith. Andy takes on the history of popcorn in America. Now, this is the snack food that is pure Americana. The first kernel was popped in the Americas several thousand years ago, and the United States is now the popcorn capital of the world. Our favorite kitchen designer, Deborah Krasner, is checking out range hoods, from so wimpy they couldn't budge a feather to so lusty you have to be careful about losing the cat. And we'll be talking pears with Barbara Jean Flores, author of The Great Book of Pears, a gourmet and garden guide from rediscovered heirlooms to modern favorites. Did you know that before Harry and David, it was the Catholic Church that took the pear from unloved and unwanted to sexy and alluring? Newspaper food editor Kathleen Purvis invites us to her kitchen hop, and then, as we do every week, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. It happens in the second half of the show, and the number's 800-537-5252. Well, those adventurous souls, Jane and Michael Stern, are ready to kick things off. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, I need someplace warm. So what are the ideas?
If you're looking for warm and you're looking for absolutely dynamite great food, go to Pensacola, Florida, to the Hopkins Boarding House. Pensacola is known by the insiders as the Redneck Riviera.
Really, well, now that we have offended a significant number of our listeners.
Well, that's what they call it. That's what the locals call it, you know, humorously. But Pensacola is right on the Gulf, and it is, you know, tropical breezes and absolutely a wonderful climate. And the Hopkins Boarding House, which probably, if Michael and I had to make our ultimate top 10 list of restaurants in this country that we love the most, Hopkins would be way up at the top of the list.
It really is, or used to be, a boarding house. People lived there and ate three meals a day there. Nobody lives there anymore, although there is one room available, but they serve three meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and supper. You sit at communal tables, and what's great about it is all the food is put out and you reach, grab, and help yourself. The rules of etiquette at a boarding house are completely different from the rules of etiquette at a normal dinner table.
But there is a lot of etiquette at Hopkins Boarding House. I mean, the price you pay for eating as much family-style food, all homemade, all prepared from scratch, as you can stand at a very low price is you have to behave yourself. This is a place with white lace curtains, portraits of the original Mrs. Hopkins, I wouldn't say glowering down on you, but looking, you know, very staunchly down on you. Mm-hmm. And there are signs that say no hats worn at table, shirts and shoes must be worn in dining room, no tank tops, no undershirts, and no muscle shirts are permissible here. This is a very polite place for polite people.
But what is the food like?
It's classic, great, deep Southern food. You know, a lot of Florida, when you sort of go down south in Florida, isn't as Southern as the Panhandle. Pensacola is real deep South, so you're going to be eating crisp, wonderful fried chicken, corn muffins, collard greens, black-eyed peas, the full repertoire of great Deep South cooking.
Absolute best fried chicken I have ever had in my life. And what I love about Hopkins is it's open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And Michael and I probably ate six meals in a row there. You know, just we ate breakfast, we ate lunch, we ate dinner, we ate breakfast, lunch, dinner the next day. And we saw regulars from the town who never miss a meal there. It is not a tourist place. This is really where the people of Pensacola eat. And breakfast, everybody comes in with their newspaper. It's like eating in somebody's home kitchen. And I had something that surprised me that it was this good in the Deep South, but I had the absolutely best pancakes I've ever had in my life at Hopkins. They were thin as doilies, crisp, succulent. There probably was a half pound of butter in each one, but so delicious.
And we actually learned the secret of why this food is so delicious when we looked in the kitchen of Hopkins Boarding House. Most of the staff in the kitchen have been there since the 1960s, 1950s. When this place was started by Mrs. Hopkins, a lot of the people that were with her then are still with her now. And these are the kind of people who know how to cook. The knowledge is in their fingers, in their hands. They, of course, never need to measure anything, but there's a certain quality that they impart to the food that cannot be written in a recipe.
Is Mrs. Hopkins still with us?
Mrs. Hopkins passed away in 1986, but her son, Edward, promised her that he would keep this place going exactly as she kept it going. In other words, enforcing those rules about the no muscle shirts, no hats worn at the table, et cetera, et cetera.
We asked Nick Geeker, who's a federal circuit court judge who eats at Hopkins probably, you know, every day of his life, what Mrs. Hopkins was like. And he said, well, she was not overbearing, but you didn't want to get out of line at the Hopkins boarding house either, or she would set you straight. So I think she was quite the matriarch.
Well, I'll have to leave my muscle shirt home, and I won't wear the short shorts, and it's Mrs. Hopkins Boarding House in Pensacola, Florida, right?
That's
the
place.
Okay. See you next week, guys.
Okay, Lynn. Happy eating.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me, and any place we chance to be, we'll be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's favorite comfort food cookbook. They come by every week, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Designer Deborah Krasner comes by from time to time with her newest ideas for our real-life kitchens. She's got a practical, can-do approach to making a kitchen work. That's probably because she's a cook who designs versus a designer who does takeout. Deborah, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Deborah, I'd like to talk about exhaust fans because the range out there is the fan that's really like a fan that has no real exhaust to these big exhaust hoods that could suck the cat out of the kitchen.
That's right.
So what do we need to know about exhaust fans in our kitchens?
You know, I've been thinking about this, and it seems to me that my thinking is really undergoing some kind of evolution about this. Because I used to think, okay, those little kind of cigarette filtery things, they don't do anything, forget about them. And the suck the cat kind is what you need because you're using these great big heavy professional burners and you really need to get that oomph. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of rules that kitchen designers use that have to do with how many cubic feet per minute are moved by a fan. And, you know, there are mathematical formulas about linear feet times 40 to get the CFMs that you need that are appropriate for your stove. And essentially the short answer is with a six burner professional style range, you need 600 cubic feet per minute. But then I started thinking about it from a practical perspective, and I thought, who uses six burners all at once? I mean, in my real life, I use two burners, mm-hmm. usually, occasionally three. So do I really need 600 feet per minute? Could I have 300? And then I started thinking not about cooking and not about, you know, the smell of fish, but more about indoor pollution. And it started to become more apparent to me, particularly with gas cooking, that anytime you flick the burner on, you're creating pollution, and that pollution is frequently without any odor. So you're not as aware of it as you are, say, when you're frying fish.
Right.
And so I started as an experiment just putting on my exhaust fan whenever I started cooking, even just boiling water. And I noticed an immediate change in the quality of the air in the upstairs of my house. And so now my feeling is that exhaust fans are even more important than I thought they were when it was just a fish and garlic odor question.
Okay, but for a lot of us, we have ranges where, you know, you sort of have the microwave on top, and then right under that is this fan. It doesn't exhaust out anywhere, and underneath that is our stovetop. I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
I guess the short answer is anything is better than nothing. And if you have an inefficient exhaust system and you know it's not exhausting outside, then what can you do to improve it? And it seems to me one thing that you could do is keep it scrupulously clean, wash those filters, make sure that whatever can be gotten out of the atmosphere will be gotten out of the atmosphere. And then the next step up is to see if there's any way to get something to exhaust outdoors. And if that's not possible, then even a rotary fan and an open window is going to improve the air quality in your house. And okay. The final thing to remember is that there are these issues about updraft versus downdraft. That is, there are now some very beautiful exhaust systems that come up behind the stove and then retract down when they're not in use. Or there are stoves like Jen Air's, which are made to be downdrafted and mm-hmm. vented through the center of the stove. The thing to remember about all of those is that heat rises. And so any downdraft system is having to be more powerful to compensate for the fact that it's sucking the heat and the pollutants down where they don't want to go instead of up where they do want to go. So given a choice, it's always better to have an overhead system.
Okay. And under any circumstances, really keep filters clean and that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. And if you're buying a new system, go for ones that'll go in the dishwasher. Make your life easy for yourself.
That's a great idea. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you.
Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner works out of her studio in Vermont. She's the author of Kitchens for Cooks. Well, coming up, popped culture, the history of America's favorite snack food, and the saga of the pear, from sour and unloved to voluptuous and sought after. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com.
Boom, boom, ba. Boom, boom, ba. Boom, boom, ba. Boom, boom, ba.
There are many things in our lives that we don't stop to consider, like popcorn, for instance. Enter Andrew F. Smith. He's a food historian who researches the foods of America. He's done a lot of work on tomatoes, even ketchup. But now he's on a new kick. His book is Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. Andy, it's good to have you back.
I'm delighted to be here, Lynn.
Now, Andy, you did your tomato quartet, your book on the history of the tomato in America and ketchup and Livingston and the tomato, etc. But I think popcorn is a stretch.
Oh, it's a wonderful story.
Okay, I'll bite. Go for it.
Oh, it's just fascinating. I mean, almost everything that people think about popcorn just isn't true. So I guess that's one thing. It's the myths that circulate out there for a variety of reasons that I enjoy puncturing. That's fun to do.
For instance?
But more importantly, well, I mean, there's this whole notion that the Native Americans gave popcorn to the colonial Europeans, and there's lots of stories about them doing so on the first Thanksgiving in Plymouth Rock. There is no evidence for these stories at all. In fact, the most likely answer is that popcorn arrived in New England from South America via whalers and traders.
So, but was it around the same time, in the 1600s, or was that much later?
No,
that was later,
this
right?
is much later, and most likely in the early 19th century. So there is no evidence of popcorn in America prior to that time.
Now, I understand that there's a theory put forth by some agricultural historians that popcorn was one of the earliest forms of corn eaten by man. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. Maize, of course, plays an extremely important role in all pre-Columbian civilizations in America. But the earliest maize was popcorn. And obviously, they dump popcorn as a major consumption item as soon as other varieties were developed, such as sweet corn, dent corn, et cetera.
So, because there are a lot of different kinds of corn.
Yes.
Yeah. So where exactly did it begin?
The best evidence is that it probably began in two separate locations, one in southern Mexico and one in northern Guatemala, not far from each other, but it's the earliest version, and all other varieties derived from popcorn.
Huh. Now, but how do people figure out how to pop corn? I mean, that's pretty sophisticated.
Well, no one knows for sure how it started, but the most likely answer is it was by accident. You can't eat popcorn kernels directly. I mean, you try and bite into one, you'll break a tooth.
Right.
So the answer is you had to figure out some other way to do it, and without metal implements, you can't really pound the kernels of popcorn easily. It's just not worth it. So the most likely answer is that the kernels were near a fire and they popped, and all of a sudden people said, wow, this is kind of interesting.
All right, but now how did it become the modern mainstay that it is now?
Well, it started for a variety of reasons. The most interesting one was it was very early on connected with children. And children love the pop, and they love the explosion, and it was an entertaining, low-cost treat. So in the 1830s, 1840s, it obviously took on that. Then there were several technological changes that came on that made it the mainstream product today. The first is the wire over the fire popper. Prior to this time, people would pop corn, and it would fly off everywhere into the floor, onto the fire itself, or elsewhere. You had to quickly clean it up and then move on to consuming it. But the wire over the fire contained the pop and made it possible where you could really make a lot of popcorn. And it became a very important American family tradition to popcorn. And it isn't true of other groups. So popcorn is much less consumed in Europe, for instance, although it's growing in consumption. But they just don't have the pattern of when people are young that they automatically consume popcorn.
Uh-huh. The recipes in your book intrigue me. Popcorn canapes?
Oh, they were wonderful. But people don't think of popcorn as a cooking ingredient. They think of it only as a snack food to be consumed during the movie,
right,
or while watching television or something like that. But the quick answer is, from the beginning, popcorn was considered a food item in its own right. And you can grind down the popcorn kernels and have popcorn flour, which tastes different than normal maize flour. It's fluffier and is much more interesting ingredient. And also, the earliest cold cereals were, in fact, related to popcorn. Well before Kellogg ever invented cornflakes, you had people pouring milk over popcorn that had been popped the night before.
Really?
So, oh, yeah. So, but you can use it in almost everything, and today it's coming back. Even you go and exciting restaurants, and you now see popcorn around entrees and in soups and in salads. And it's having a renaissance today.
You live in New York, obviously, Andy.
I mean, it's not having a renaissance in Minneapolis?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but now that we're talking about it, who knows what's going to happen. But, Andy, this popularity is interesting because if you pop popcorn without any of the oil or the salt, this is not one of the great tasting foods in the world. So this popularity is intriguing.
I'm sorry to report, but that your observation is absolutely true. If you put popcorn in a hot air popper, it doesn't taste like popcorn. And the reason for that is simple. They've bred out the taste of popcorn because all of the taste tests were conducted with butter, with salt, and with oil as a popping medium. So you really have a flavorless popcorn. And for those of us that are always on a diet, it's hard to eat that type of popcorn without all the flavorings.
Well, I still think the popcorn canapé is going to be my choice of the new dish to try.
Give it a chance. Give it a shot. You know, you'll like it.
Andy, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Andrew Smith teaches culinary history at the New School University in Manhattan, and he's author of Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. Now, you can get Andy's recipe for popcorn canapés. This is a must. Go to our website. That's splendidtable.org. Kathleen Purvis is the food editor of the Charlotte Observer newspaper in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, this is a big job. Most of us don't know what it entails. You sort of need a secret weapon to pull a food editorship off.
So, I'm headed into the kitchen to test recipes. Now, let's get something straight right here. I'm a newspaper food editor, and newsrooms aren't exactly generous when it comes to things like equipment. Most consider themselves fully stocked if they provide you with an empty notebook and a pen that works. And you might have to crawl under a desk to find that pen. So by test kitchen, understand that we're not talking gleaming domestic science lab here. We're talking my own kitchen, in my house, with my non-professional electric stove, my chipped avocado sink, and my basic home-sized dishwasher. But there is one piece of equipment that I consider absolutely essential to serious cooking, more important than my 10-inch Sabatier chef's knife, more reliable than my gray steel KitchenAid mixer, more indispensable than my entire set of Calphalon, my CD player with the 6-disc changer. With this baby in my life, I can cook like Louis Armstrong on red beans and rice. In the last 5 years, I've worked out a reliable music routine. Call it the Good Cook's Guide to Cooking by Note. First, we'll start with a little opera. Italian, please. Puccini, in fact. This is my favorite from Great Voices of the Century. Sun floods through my big kitchen window. Joan Hammond soars. I am invincible, eternal, connected to generations of cooks. Next, I need to get into full swing.
I like the green grass under my shoes.
This is from the Ella Fitzgerald songbook, her recordings of famous composers like Duke Ellington, Cole Porter, and Jerome Kern. That's why this lady is a tramp. Right about here is a good time to slip into the Gypsy Kings. I know, restaurants play them so much, Spanish guitars have become a food cliche. I don't care. Those rapid-fire hand claps are made for chopping. Even if I'm testing cakes, I get out a cutting board and dice an onion just to keep my hand in. By the fourth CD, I've hit trudging mode. It's after lunch and into that dull afternoon stretch. I need the blues. No, really. I mean the blues. The four CD set from the Smithsonian.
You ain't nothing but a hound.
This is my favorite disc, number 4. That's Mabel Thornton's original version of Hound Dog. Sorry, Elvis, honey, you can't touch Big Mama. By now, my brain is on automatic pilot. It's time for something more modern, something I can sing along to, loudly. Annie Lennox, or the Pretenders. Are talking heads speaking in tongues. Although this cut is a dangerous thought for a tired cook. Oh, Lordy. By now I've loaded and emptied the dishwasher at least twice. The teaspoons are stuck together, and I've lost my dish towel under a pile of empty brown sugar boxes. I need cleanup music, something to get me through tasting one more marinara and finding a way to fit 5 kinds of pot roast into a packed refrigerator. This is a job for... Pink Floyd, music of my youth. Music that makes me feel like I've got unlimited time and energy. I will make the New York Times someday, or I will at least subscribe to the New York Times someday. Whatever. Now, it's true. 6 CDs will not get you through 8 hours of cooking. So when I hit the end, I just punch start and do the whole thing again. Puccini to Pink Floyd. That's something they don't teach you at the Cordon Bleu. I'll see you on the dark side of the moon.
Kathleen Purvis is food editor at the Charlotte Observer newspaper in Charlotte, North Carolina. I came across some unexpected information in a new book. It's called The Great Book of Pears, a gourmet and garden guide from rediscovered heirlooms to modern favorites. It's by Barbara Jean Flores. In the book, she explains the sweet dessert pears that we eat are very different from pears of the past. Pears first surfaced 4,000 years ago, and for a very long time, they were sour and small and hard. In fact, these were the kinds of pears the English have used for hundreds of years to make a popular drink. It's a lot like cider. It's called perry. Well, we wanted to know more, so we asked Barbara Jean Flores to join us in the studio. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Let's talk pear history. I mean, how did the dessert pear come about, these luscious, you know, succulent babies that we swoon over?
Well, the wealthy wanted pears at the table because that was considered, a sign of their wealth, a sign of their power. Mm-hmm. And so they brought these pears from the Mediterranean areas, from the Middle East, Greece, and began developing these. And by the Renaissance period, one duke was known to have as many as 207 pears just at his table.
Different kinds?
Different kinds, all different kinds.
Huh. Now, is it my imagination, or is the pear growing in the United States centered on the West Coast?
Oh, it's definitely centered on the West Coast, because pears were brought over from Europe. Thomas Jefferson, for example, really loved the pears of France, and he wanted to grow them in Monticello, but he had difficulty. He tried 17 varieties, and it was only the American Seckel that he was really, really successful at. But not at the French varieties he knew. It's California where that ended up taking off. California had the perfect climate for growing pears. But they did not spread from the East to California.
How did they get there?
the West Coast pears actually came up through Mexico, Peru, South America, traveling with the missions. As Father Sarah came up and established the missions, one of his orders was to plant fruits, not just grapes, but other fruits. And so they took these pears and grew them in the West Coast.
Now, there's this string of 21 missions that essentially the monks built in California. They're each a mm-hmm. day's journey apart. So you're saying that's where the pear began on the West Coast?
The pear on the West Coast started with a huge mission gardens. We have one mission here today that's got the oldest pear tree. This is in San Juan Batista Mission.
Uh-huh.
We went searching for this pear tree, and we actually found it. And it had, this last year, 21 pears on it. It was just kind of remarkable.
For 21 missions.
For 21 missions. Yes, they considered it a little miracle that this happened, since this pear tree was planted in 1810.
Now, is anybody preserving these old varieties of pears?
There is an estate in California, and it's where I really looked for pears. Originally, we were doing a pear poster, and I went there to look for heirloom varieties. And I found all sorts of varieties that I had never seen before. And this was an orchard that was planted in 1919 by William Bourne, who was a gold magnate, made all this money on his gold mine, and he wanted an orchard that mirrored the orchards of the great classic estates of Italy. And so he planted a 1,000-tree orchard of mixed fruit where he had many, many varieties of pears. Unfortunately, it fell into neglect because when the property became a historical property, they wanted to preserve the formal gardens near the house, as well as the furniture in the house, the furnishings of this huge 43-room mansion.
Mm-hmm.
But the orchard then ended up falling into neglect.
I gather it's come back. How did it come back?
Well, the Lucy Tolmach, who is the horticultural director there, had been trying ever since 1973 to restore this orchard. And with the help of other people who were gathering rare varieties of fruit all over the United States, she put a plan together to preserve these pears, and the board approved it. So it's a very exciting project because it's a state historical property, which means it can't be sold. So these wonderful rare heirloom fruits will be preserved for future generations.
Barbara, heirlooms mm-hmm. aside, mm-hmm. for those of us who buy our pears in the supermarket, are there pears that you think really have great taste? What should we be looking for?
When you go to the supermarket, first of all, I'd look for a ripe pear, and you might find a ripe pear best by pressing the stem end, and when it gives a little bit with your thumb at the stem end, then that shows that's ripe. Now, I find that the Comice are the most delicious. You know, the Comice are the Riviera pears that are sent by mail order companies. So if you can buy Comice, they're wonderful. They're very good for eating out of hand, but they're not as great for poaching. Poaching, you want a pear that really holds its shape, mm-hmm. and a beautiful shape is the Bosque. They look wonderful standing up in a goblet, chocolate sauce dripping down, little whipped cream. It's wonderful.
Barbara, thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara Jean Flores is author of The Great Book of Pears. You can get Barbara's recipe for Moraga pear pie by going to our website. That's splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our trivia question of the week. And I found a tidbit in that book we were talking about, The Great Book of Pears. It's about the carol, The 12 Days of Christmas. You know it. You know, on the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a partridge in a pear tree. Now, I think that's a pretty odd gift. I mean, why would your true love give you a partridge in a pear tree? First of all, where would you put it? And secondly, what does it mean? Well, we're going to be back in a moment with the answer, and we'll be taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll be opening the lines for your call soon, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, you know the old carol, The 12 Days of Christmas. What was the significance of giving your true love a partridge in a pear tree? Well, actually, it was a pretty racy gift. Barbara Jean Flores, author of the aforementioned Book of Pears, says that in the Middle Ages, I'm going to have to put this rather delicately. Let's put it this way. The pear was a symbol of male physiology, and the partridge was an emblem of lust. So, as Barbara puts it, to give a partridge in a pear tree to your true love suggested intentions far beyond adding to her garden collection. Now, about the same time the 12 Days of Christmas became popular, monks in Europe discovered a system for propagating pears that's still used today. You graft a piece of a pear tree onto quince rootstock. Now, as both of the plants grow, you keep trimming back the quince. And if you do that, you get a pear tree with pears. So you don't plant a pear seed. You always have to have a tree to begin with. Now, speaking of growing pears, have you ever seen the whole pear in the bottle? It's in a clear brandy called Pear William. So how do you get the whole pear inside of the bottle? Well, I saw this done once. They actually slip the bottle over the pear when it's just gone from being a blossom to having all the petals fall off and the first little bit of fruit comes up. The pear grows in the bottle. It's cut off the tree. You fill it with brandy that's been made from pears, and you have a great conversation piece for sipping with pear desserts. Okay, I think we've sufficiently covered pears for today. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can phone us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We have Martin on the line. Martin, what's on your mind?
Well, I really enjoy eggplant, but yet it seems that every recipe that I've come across, they talk about adding a couple, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, and in order to saute the eggplant,
right.
But when I do it, within a matter of seconds, the eggplant soaks up all the olive oil, and I don't know where to go from there, so I end up adding more to the point that I think it has, you know, probably too much.
So you're saying that maybe your frying of eggplant karma isn't very good?
Absolutely not. I've tried high heat, low heat, and I just can't seem to find that magic balance between the two.
Okay. Do you salt your eggplant before you use it, before you cook it?
I've never tried salting it.
No. Okay. Let me give you a few tips. Now, I want to know one thing, though. What is your goal? Do you want fried eggplant or do you want sautéed? You know, fried eggplant meaning a bit on the crisp on the outside and soft and melting in the mouth on the inside. Or are you looking at sautéed eggplant?
Actually, I saute the eggplant, or I attempt to saute the eggplant, before using it in, like, even like in a Parmesan type.
Oh, okay. I think I'm going to teach you how to fry eggplant. Because that's the real way to do it. And,
excellent.
Yeah, and believe it or not, I don't think you get any more fat in the eggplant. Okay, the first thing you have to do is, eggplant is this sponge. It holds a lot of liquid. So this is why a lot of recipes have you salting the eggplant. Now, if you're doing eggplant parmigiana, what you want to do is slice the eggplant from top to bottom, you know, from the stem end down, so you get this kind of long pear-shaped slice.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
The fiber runs that way. It tends to hold together better. That's just one reason to do it. And you want it in about between a quarter and a half inch thick. And then what I do is I salt it lightly on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I lay it on a triple thickness of paper towel, top it with another triple thickness of paper towel. You know, I lay it out in one layer.
Right. right.
And I put a cutting board on top of it or a baking pan, anything to press it. And if the thing isn't very heavy, I put cans of, you know, food in it.
Right.
And I wait it and I leave it at least a half hour. But between you and me, I've left it for 4 or 5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens is you've pressed out a lot of liquid. When you take that apart, you'll see the paper towels are wet. That will help the eggplant not absorb quite as much.
That's interesting. You think that it would do just the opposite?
No, it really seems to help it, but I'm not. It still is a little blotter. It's going to absorb something.
Right.
But the other key is that you want to make sure you have 1 inch of oil in your pan. Use a big saute pan. Okay, this is what I meant about. We're not going to saute. We're going to fry.
Mm-hmm.
So 1 inch of oil, all right? And then you have a choice. If you want to, you could dip it in egg and then into breadcrumbs and you get a crust on the outside. Or just fry it naked.
Mm-hmm.
Get the oil hot. Now, how do you know if it's hot? Take a tip of the eggplant slice and just dip it in. And if it sizzles, the oil's hot enough.
Mm-hmm.
Now, put in 2 slices maybe, 3 at the most. You don't want a crowd.
Right.
And keep that oil pretty hot. And I would bet after 2 or 3 minutes of frying, turn them over with tongs, submerge them in the oil, you know, press them down gently, drain them on paper towels, and I think you're going to like the result a lot. The center will be very tender and creamy, and the outside will be a little crisp.
And I'll still have oil in my pan for the next 3 slices?
Yes, you will still have oil in your pan. And by the way, if you dip it in beaten egg and then in breadcrumb, it's more of a sealant. You'll have more oil in your pan.
Well, that's fantastic, and I can't wait to try.
Okay, just remember, make sure that oil's hot. That helps seal the outside.
I will.
Enjoy.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
We've got Erica on the line. So, Erica, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I have a huge question about a little bean.
I love huge questions. And what's the little bean?
Well, last year we were traveling in Spain and on the East Coast, and we were just strolling around markets, and we kept seeing these displays of beans, and we'd see all these different types. But there's this one kind of bean called an Asturiana that, for some reason, cost 3 times more than any other bean. It was this beautiful kind of creamy white little bean that looked kind of like a cannellini.
Yeah,
and we actually
like a white kidney bean.
Yeah.
Yeah, that size, that shape, right.
Yeah. And so we bought some and vacuum packed it and brought it home with all of our other goodies, and I still haven't cooked them because I'm wondering, what's the deal with this bean?
Asturiana in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, dear, I don't have a clue because I have to tell you, my knowledge of Spanish cuisine just isn't what it should be. But you're saying it's creamy white?
Mm-hmm.
Does it have any speckling on it?
No, it's just a smooth, elongated, not as curved as a kidney bean.
Is it about the size of a kidney bean?
A little bit longer.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would lay bets, and you know, I've spent a lot of time researching beans in Italy, of course, mm-hmm. because I've done so much work there. And I know there that as you go from place to place, the same bean, essentially,'s name might change.
Right.
But also, there are so many variations on the same theme. For instance, the bean we might call a scarlet runner.
Right.
You know, which is a beige bean that is dappled with sort of a maroon color.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably 20 different strains of that bean, and
right.
each one has a different taste.
Right.
This is probably true of your Asturiana, and this is what I think I'd do with it. I would, first of all, just cook it very, very simply. I'd get my hands. Now, you were probably tasting some pretty decent Spanish olive oil while you were there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you bring any of that home with you?
A little bit. We also have some wonderful Italian olive oil.
Okay. Why not do the classic Mediterranean thing you would do with a grape bean, where the bean will stand out? Take that bean, soak it, pour boiling water over it, let it soak about an hour,
mm-hmm.
drain it,
mm-hmm.
put it in a pan, cover it with about 3 inches of cold water. Okay. I would add about, for a cup of beans, I'd add a big clove of garlic that I crushed. And maybe a half of an onion that I cut up. Just to give it a nice flavor.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And I'd simmer that bean until it's tender. And then I'd serve it with salt and pepper on it and sprinkle it with really nice olive oil. You know, an olive oil you want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this way, your bean will stand out. You will taste the bean. Now, I'm not sure what's done with it traditionally, but
right.
if it's a very precious bean, if it was so expensive in the market, somebody's got to be eating it this way, because this is pretty much what you find across the globe, you know, when it comes to great beans, this very simple preparation.
Wonderful. Well, I'll let you know how it goes.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. So give us a ring. Anything goes, guys. We will take a shot at anything you want to talk about. Now, we have David on the line. So, David, what's on your mind?
Hello, Lynn.
Yes, David.
I purchased some seasoning of sumac at a Oriental food store, and I was from a recipe in Jeff Smith cookbook, Remembering the Feast, and I have a quart of this stuff left over, and I've given some to my friends, and I like it, but what do I do with the rest of it? Is it, I kind of garnish hummus with it or baba ganoush. Can I kind of sprinkle it on salads a little bit, but you got any help there? Maybe a sauce, tea,
oh, well, okay.
Put it on.
Well, why don't we get everybody into the loop with us? Why don't you tell everybody what it tastes like and what it looks like?
Well, it's darkish red,
right?
Flowery kind of tasting, a little bit tart, and that's.
It has a lemony sour taste, right?
Bitter sour,
right?
So kind of tough.
Well, you know, first of all, it's interesting because it's from the Middle East. And it comes from the sumac berry, but not a poisonous kind of sumac.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's actually the berry that's crushed. Now,
okay.
Now what I was going to say, let me think now. I love this stuff. I put it on lamb.
Okay.
It is a natural, it's very traditional on yogurt.
Yogurt.
And on any seafood. Now, in Turkey, there's a relish that they do. And I'm kind of dim on this one, but let me see. Chopped onion, okay, that you put on ice. You know, so it gets very crisp and it loses a lot of its heat.
Okay.
And you mix that with olive oil, a little bit of olive oil, lots of garlic, and then you sprinkle it generously with the sumac. So it really gets this fantastic color because the sumac turns things almost magenta.
Uh-huh.
So if you use a lot of it, and that's a relish that you put on things like grilled lamb and grilled fish. Really easy to do. So you put the onions on ice for maybe a half hour.
Okay.
Take them off the ice, toss them with garlic and olive oil, and then a lot of the sumac.
Okay.
And salt and pepper to taste, obviously. And if you want to add a little bit of vinegar, you could.
Okay.
And are you familiar with the books of Paula Wolfert?
No.
She's a food writer who writes brilliantly about the Mediterranean. And I remember she talks about sumac. She did a book called The Foods of the Eastern Mediterranean. It came out several years ago.
Okay.
You'll find it on the net and find it in bookstores. And I remember she had an incredible eggplant and lamb dish with a sumac sauce that turned the eggplant magenta.
Mediterranean.
It's called The Foods of the Eastern Mediterranean by Paula Wolfert. Now, because you have so much of it, by the way,
yep.
I'd put a lot of it in the freezer because, you know, this is the kind of thing that doesn't keep forever and stay in prime shape. So put a big portion of it in the freezer.
All right.
Okay.
Hey, I think I'm going to try the lamb dish tonight.
Oh, try the lamb. It'll be wonderful. It'll be great.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
Hey, enjoy the sumac.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Jean's on the line. So, Jean, what pressing matter do you have to discuss with us?
Well, I have a very small kumquat tree that is weighted down with fruit and ripe and should be picked right now. Some time ago, a friend of mine gave me a kumquat chutney.
Ooh.
That I thought was excellent, and I have never been able to find a recipe for it. It was just so good with roast pork.
Mm.
It had onion and, you know, it was similar to the... I don't know what are chutneys made of.
Well, there's lots of things chutneys are made of, but you know where I'd start? And this is a recipe you can find in a lot of books. A green tomato chutney, and I'd substitute the kumquats for the green tomatoes. Usually it's things like vinegar, brown sugar, a ton of garlic, a lot of green tomatoes I'd use, because green tomatoes are sort of sweet sour.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know, I've always heard this, and I've eaten kumquats, you know, very rarely, because where do you live, by the way, that you have a tree in your backyard?
Oh, Pasadena, California.
Oh, you poor babe. Here we are, 45 below, and you've got a kumquat tree that's coming into full flower in your backyard.
Yes, it's 80 degrees today.
All right, Jean. Okay.
I know you didn't want to hear that.
I know. I didn't. It's okay, though, dear. I forgive you. I have always heard that a fresh kumquat is really interesting because the pulp is sour and the skin is sweet. Is that true?
Yes. I think that's what makes it edible. You can eat them right off the tree. Just wash them and eat them right off the tree. They're pretty tart.
Uh-huh.
I know they make wonderful jelly, but
yeah, they do. And you can put them in sugar syrup, you know, and candy them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great, too. Whatever was in that original chutney you love so much, mm-hmm. work it in here. But I suggest the green tomato recipes because generally they're going to give you a good starting point.
Well, thank you, Lynn, very much.
Oh, let us know how this turned out.
I will.
And I promise not to grit my teeth every time I think of you with your kumquat tree.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for calling. Kumquat trees. You know, there's something that people in California and people who live in the South know that we folks who live in the North rarely ever experience. You take citrus fruit straight from the tree, something like a lemon. I can't explain to you how alive and how luscious. And if you're lucky enough to be living right now in a place where you've got really fresh citrus, try an old recipe that's been around for I don't know how long. I think it goes back to the Renaissance. Take fresh bay leaves and lots of sliced fresh lemons and just lay them over a roast chicken that you've butterflied. Put that in the fridge overnight, take it out the next day, and then roast it just as it is with salt, pepper, and garlic until it's crisp outside and all of the fruit is crisp. Unbelievable, because that flavor, that flowery, lovely, fragrant lemon permeates the flesh of the chicken. Just delicious. Hey, everybody, thanks for calling. Remember, you can reach us anytime. Our answering machine loves company. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with some wisdom from Bridget Bardot. She says, "It is sad to grow old, but nice to ripen." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully-forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. To get information on any of the guests you've heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lukey and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.